There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve. Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 740, November 13, 2017. Nasser?
Thank you, sir. One more to go for the season, and one more before it's sayonara forever for Massa.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Villeneuve slams Bottas. What if Honda is faster than Renault next year? How many Massa goodbyes can we take? And we have an interview with American Lotus personnel, Kenny Szymanski. And of course, we need to remind our listeners that we need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab on the front page. You know you want to. Nas, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Very, very good, sir. Thank you. I had a very busy weekend. I was working for the man on Saturday, then took a flight to JFK for a meeting and conversation with Kenny Szymanski, who, as you said, worked for Lotus when Senna and Mansell were the drivers. Really enjoyed our conversation and his stories and experiences. Many thanks to him. We met first time in Austin, and it all happened because, just like, you know, you and I met because you posted a photo of you in front of Reims grandstand. He was there in the media room wearing a Lotus yellow shirt, and I said, wow, this is from days gone by. And he says, yeah, I work for them. So I asked him if he was Kenny Szymanski. One thing led to another, so we met in Manhattan, had a great time, great conversation, great stories, and some mighty fine homey food, and we capped the evening with Mr. Kenny doing a toast to Vijay Mallya with some Kingfisher beer.
Wow, that's very exciting. I need some excitement, Nasser, because I'm having a lack of Bravo physical.
Well, you're more than welcome to fly to St. Petersburg. And then I'll take you to Dale Earnhardt Chevy, and you can go get all your new motivation from there.
Thank you, Nasser. Keep up the good work.
So, season is coming to an end. Are you feeling nostalgic, sad, or how's it going on the left coast for you?
Very sad. No Fernando podiums, no Fernando's top fives, no Fernando's, no Bravo, Bravo, Bravo.
You mentioned about Jacques Villeneuve. What's his steal, man? About him and Bottas?
I don't know. He's just bitter inside. Bottas just can't take it anymore. Villeneuve has to just lash out at anybody who's not beating Lewis Hamilton. I have no idea. It's bizarre, but it is what it is.
Well, you know, I have to agree with JV on this, but the way he's going, I think he may pretty soon have another team telling him, you know, please don't come here.
No, boy.
You know, when a team with whom you won the championship is telling you not to come, don't come around here no more, that's pretty sad.
That's very sad, especially since he's their last world champion.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Wow. So there you have it. Vettel gets a win. Hamilton puts it into the wall.
You know, when I heard LCH was out, I missed most of quali because I was working and also the race because of traveling. But when I heard LCH was out in Q1 after a crash, my first thought was, here we go again, like the post-championship races in 2015 when he could not do anything but Nico Rosberg kept winning. But, you know, these things happen even to the very best. Bottas taking pole was good for Toto and his entourage, but the gap to Seb in second was so close, it was obvious it was not going to be a all-happy samba for 71 laps for Valtteri. And as it turned out, it was not even a happy samba for one lap. So So one has to see the point that JV is making.
Absolutely. I mean, let's face it. There are number ones and there are number twos.
So, you know, both him and Kimi have now become part of the Chiquita culture. They are now in the what I call the Chiquita banana bandwagon. Not bad for a number two.
That's nice that Rubinho was there.
Yeah, he was there. Yeah, the eternal number two.
Yeah, that was nice to see him interview Massa at the after the podium.
Yeah, I have missed most of that, but I DVR'd the thing, so hopefully I'll watch it today or tomorrow. But Max on row two was no surprise, but Nando on row three was mega machismo. Can you imagine Fernando Alonso and Max Verstappen in Mercedes' team?
That would be so good. So delectable.
Yes, and what's up with your man, Cyril, a beat pool of Renault and Toro Rosso, being on the Don Henley program, airing their dirty laundry in public. And I saw a brief video of him talking to Dr. Marco. I mean, I thought he was going to give him a real, you know, nice French uppercut. But the baby bull team has gone so far to accuse Renault of sabotage because they have some part shortages. And not surprisingly, Alonso is already feeling sorry for Toro Rosso as they will have the GP2 package next year. Yeah. I wonder, man, what's going to happen to Honda with Toro Rosso.
I don't know. It might be a good marriage. You never know.
Yeah, if they think they have a problem with Renault right now, wait till they realize the full potential of the GP2 engine.
So exciting.
It is pretty sad, man. It's very, very sad. It's not good for motorsport. But, you know, I'm tracking the progress of Carlos Sainz Jr. at Renault with a lot of interest. And so far, he has done a very good job compared to his much-experienced teammate, Mr. Nico Hülkenberg, especially if you keep in mind that Nico destroyed both Julian Palmer and Esteban Gutierrez as teammates. So I think that we may have some cage rattling at Renault next year.
We could. It's going to be exciting, especially if the package is gets them up in the top five where they're fighting for points and podiums. I'm hoping Renault does well. I'm hoping McLaren does well. Next year, hopefully, is going to be something interesting.
Yeah, we may have several different teams win races. And it was good to see Massa in Q3 and qualify in top 10 for his final home Grand Prix. And the question was, will you miss Felipe Baby after Abu Dhabi?
No. I was supposed to miss him last year. So,
you think he will come to IndyCar racing?
You know, it's hard to say, but I think he will. I think he'll do a little Rubinho action and come here for a little while. But in the end, it's going to be, you know, he could do the Brazilian stock cars or he might do Le Mans, Daytona. Maybe he'll do a little truck series.
You know, Alonso insulted Honda at Suzuka by saying GP2 engine. Now there are reports he may drive for Toyota at Le Mans. And even though Porsche is gone, or maybe gone, but I wonder what he will say if he's driving a Toyota at Le Mans and it's not competitive. What is he going to do then?
Well, Toyota was competitive at Le Mans, so
I think this is what he will do. If the Toyota package is not competitive, at least when he's driving, I think he's going to say Honda hybrid.
It's possible. Who knows? But Fernando needs some magic to come back his way.
I think this guy has realized that his buddy Lewis Hamilton and Sebastian will have a fifth championship before he will have his third. So now he's looking into Le Mans and Indy. And good for him. But it's just a really, really sad. Such a tremendous talent is still looking for his third championship after a decade. And it's bad for motorsports.
It is, but it, you know, that's how the dice fell. That's how the chips landed. And I think going elsewhere, and you know, it brings his entourage. I mean, at Daytona, he'll be the talk of the town, like he was at Indy. And it brings more fans to Daytona. More F1 fans are going to peek in to see what's going on over there. So, in terms of the global motorsports, I think Fernando is doing us all a great big favor.
Oh, yeah, one good thing, him being at Daytona, that the other drivers will feel the lack of media people around them, so maybe I can get some decent interviews.
There you go.
And speaking of which, please go to the Daytona 24-hour website and submit media credentials for more.
Yes, please. Of course. Just send me an email to remind me, please.
That has been done, but I can send you a reminder on a reminder. No
please,
problem.
You know, I'm so busy trying to make a living that sometimes the F1 Weekly checks bounce.
They're bouncing. Your own checks are bouncing on you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty sad.
I know, but it is one of those things here at F1 Weekly. Too many zeros, not enough digits.
Yes. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about the race. I mean, I really, you know, I'll tell you, if this race proves anything to me, it was really just like this victory for Sebastian was just like his first victory, where he was starting next to another Finnish driver who did not even make a fake attempt to pass him. And it was the same thing, you know. I mean, do you think the way Lewis went in the race, I think if Lewis was on the front row, he probably would have won the race.
I think so, too. Bottas was a little wimpy. On the other hand, maybe Sebastian Vettel has already felt out Bottas and knows his style and knew that he wouldn't fight. There it was. I mean, he got him, first corner, boom, and the race was his. And the Ferrari's pace was very, very good, you have to admit.
Yeah, but, you know, once again, their top dog was the man, you know, on the move. And it's just amazing. It's, you know, it's not very big, but it's clear to see difference between a very good driver and a great driver. And we see that at Ferrari and at Mercedes.
Yeah, and I think there's a certain amount of aggression that could be lacking in Bottas. So
yeah, it's you know what it is, when you get into these situations with certain drivers, if you become their teammate, it's like Carlos Sainz, and this is the real reason I'm interesting to see how Sainz stacks up. I mean, he's keeping up with just like Sergio Perez a couple of years ago. He had the upper hand, or at least the same performance as Nico Hülkenberg. I think in their last year together, I think Sergio did a better job. But if you just fumble season long, then nobody's going to ever pick you up as a number one driver. I mean, you look at what's happening with Red Bull. Danny Boy had Max's number all season long last year. But this year, most of the time when you look at the starting grid, Mad Max is ahead of him.
No, it's amazing. And I'm sure it's frustrating for Ricciardo. But Ricciardo, I don't know, he's had some bad luck. But no, I have to admit it. He's his cage is done.
Yeah, and you know, it's I would love to see him as a teammate to Lewis or Sebastian. Let's see what happens. That's the beauty of Formula One, man. When you were at the top, I mean, like when he was with Sebastian Vettel, won three races, Seb was zero. I mean, everybody was going gaga about him. But now people are looking at it from a different angle, you know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's only a matter of time before somebody rattles Max's cage. And, you know, what goes around comes around.
I know, but it's going to be an exciting season next year, especially if Renault picks up the pace a little bit and Max is really competitive against Mercedes.
Yeah, I think we. I have a strong feeling that McLaren will have a win or two.
Yes, I think so too. But I also have to admit that watching Fernando in the mix there, in finishing sixth, and it was very impressive staying in the top 10. The car looked good.
Oh, yeah. The car, I mean, he's the difference, you know, in that team, and that's for sure.
But, of course, the talk of the race was Lewis Hamilton, race, you know, starting from 19th, eventually leading the race for a while as Vettel and Bottas pit. So it was pretty impressive on the timesheets when it showed him leading, and it, you know, it says made 19 places. I mean, to make up 19 spots in a race is pretty impressive.
Yeah, but you know the caliber of driver he is and the package he has. I mean, I mean, it's not just him. Even Sebastian Vettel, if they started the rock bottom or the pit lane, I for sure expect them in the top five or top four. Top three will get, you know, you need some help, maybe a Kablamo or something. But at his level, I mean, if you put Max Verstappen in that Mercedes or that Ferrari and have him start from the bottom, I would expect the guy to be in the top five.
I agree. No, and we've seen it with the Schumachers and the Fernandos.
Oh, yeah.
So, no, you're right. But it was fun to watch. I enjoyed the Grand Prix. The thing that I thought was stunning, that there was no rain at all. It was a beautiful, dry day.
Yeah, it was. And rain would have, especially with Lewis being in the back, would have been a good thing. And we could have seen another outstanding performance from Mr. Max. But anything stands out for you from the race?
Vettel won, Lewis didn't. That stood out.
Yeah. And of course, Romain Grosjean, man, I don't know what's his deal. Both of Haas cars were out on the first lap. And
him getting tangled up with Ocon, and then Grosjean freaking out because he got a 10-second penalty, drive-through penalty, because he was hitting Ocon. But I don't know. I don't know what's going on with Grosjean. He's just not what he used to be. And he might be out of F1 very soon if that continues.
Yeah, we talked about this, I think, last podcast also. You know, he's complaining quite a bit. And these people need to know. I mean, you know, there are quite a few, as Penske told Paul Tracy's dad when they came to sign a contract with him. They wanted 24 hours to look at it. And Roger said, there are 10 guys standing outside. Sign now or it's over. So Gene Haas can give the same treatment to Romain Grosjean, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm sure Kvyat would love to drive for Haas.
Well, talking of Kvyat, is he going to drive for Williams or Kubica? Is it? It's a K factor now, the K car. The Williams would be the K car, and it's, you know, apropos for that package, you know, at least for now.
Are we talking about the Chrysler K car?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, Leah Iacocca?
Yeah.
Bravo.
Well, Kvyat or Kubica?
It's going to be Kubica.
You think so?
I think so. I have a funny feeling. Well, we'll see. He's going to test the 2017 car in Abu Dhabi. I'm telling you, Kubica's, he wants to come back. I think he's got sponsorship from some Polish sausage company. And I have a funny feeling that he's gonna bring Williams back to the forefront. That is going to be the rest of the story.
You know, I know it's a feel-good story, but I think, just my opinion, they would be better off taking Pascal Wehrlein or Charles Leclerc, some one of these young guns, you know, and see if they can find a gem in them.
I know, but feel-good stories are what bring sponsors and what brings press and what brings the talk of the town.
Yeah, maybe they can bring a big sponsorship from Warsaw Commercial Bank or some bank of Bologna. I don't know.
I don't know either, but I'm telling you, it could be a coup for Williams to get, because he's so desperate to drive, he's going to be inexpensive, and because he's going to prove himself, he might even drive free for the first 6 months.
Yeah, Dick, you know what would be a good idea for Williams? They already have one son of a billionaire. Maybe they could get Sergei Sirotkin, this Russian kid, who at one time signed a deal with Sauber under the name of Russian Helicopters. So maybe they can have two billionaire kids driving for them.
No, I mean, I'm hoping Kubica's back. At least give him a shot. As a matter of fact, listen, tell Massa to go home with Rubinho and stick Kubica in the car for Abu Dhabi.
Boy, you're really sold on Robert Kubica today, huh?
I am. It'd be something exciting for the last race, for God's sakes. Am I wrong here?
No, I think they're going to just... I think everybody's getting tired. You sound like Cyril Abitbol and Franz Tost. You just want to pick up a fight with somebody.
That's true. You know, the season's over. We've lost another championship to Lewis Hamilton. I'm bitter.
Yeah. But you know what I'm really looking forward to? Who will get number 5 for Seb or LCH? That'll be fantastic, man. What an achievement for these kids, man. 5-time world champion, same as Fangio. Wow.
Well, that's going to be the exciting thing next year with Vettel and LCH tied at 4. Then the championship really becomes important.
Yeah, the fight will be fantastic.
The fight will be fantastic, but don't forget, it's Fernando's year next year.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, that Lewis showed a lot of maturity this year. I mean, you know, he has scored points in every race. And if you look at the Singapore shenanigans from Sebastian, I would not call it shenanigans. Who wants to lose the lead of the race, but he could have been a little bit more careful. And then this Baku thing that he did, that was really, if he is, you know, maybe he'll get rattled, his cage will get rattled again by Lewis next year. It all depends on how good the Ferrari package is.
That's very, very true. I completely agree. But you never know. I mean, the thing that's unbelievable is, I know this is hard to believe, but Ferrari could suck next year.
Why do you say that?
Because it's happened. You have a great year and then you go down. I mean, McLaren and the Renault package could be a marriage made in heaven. I'm in heaven.
Well, I mean, there are not many major changes in the technical department that will make some competitive car go totally cuckoo. But I think the biggest jump would be seen in McLaren with the Renault engine, which has won. How many races they won this year? Three, right? Two for Max and one for Danny Boy?
Correct. But yeah, but don't forget, Adrian Newey is not involved with Red Bull like they used to be. And Eric Boullier has said it. Our package, our chassis, and now this new front wing that they've had for a couple of races has made huge differences to the McLaren. With good horsepower and drivability, this McLaren could really come alive.
I will not be surprised if it's in the same league as Red Bull this year, you know, competitive and winning races. Will not. I'm not sure if they will fight for the championship, but I do expect Fernando to win some races.
Well, I expect Fernando to win every race now, sir.
Do you remember when I was thinking the other day about a couple of Nando's races with McLaren, first time out? He won his, if I remember correctly, his second ever race with McLaren in Malaysia, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, remember his car and Lewis was right behind him. And then he won the Monza Grand Prix with McLaren that year. And I was at that race. And I remember Lewis making a fantastic late-breaking pass on Raikkonen. But Alonso was untouchable at Monza that day.
Yep, totally untouchable. So wonderful. Oh, Nasser, those were the days. But we have good days coming up, and we have one more race in Abu Dhabi, so everything's going to be fine. But, you know, I have to admit, I'm actually quite excited about this this interview with former American Lotus worker bee, as we call him, Kenny Szymanski. This has got to be a great interview for us.
No, this is fantastic. You know, the stories these people have who were there behind the scene. You know, as a racing fans, which we are, what we hear is what broadcasts on racing news, the headlines. But when you go behind the headlines is when you get the, what you call meat and potatoes.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the meat and potatoes, and then I think we should go right to this interview. Let's not take a break. We're not going to spin the globe. We're not going to waste any time. Since Fernando is not going to win this year, let's go right to Kenny.
Yes, and I would like people to listen to Kenny in his own words. I want him to tell the story, not me saying things. So please enjoy this conversation. And Kenny, thank you so much. Great meeting you. And hopefully I will see you again at Daytona or St. Pete.
Hello, race fans. My name is Kenny Szymanski. I worked with Lotus from 77 to 88. And I'm very proud to be here with the fans of F1 Weekly.
Kenny, great to meet you. First of all, how are you today? And tell us a little bit about your take on the Brazilian Grand Prix today.
That was good. I enjoy watching every Formula One race. I mean, once that's in your blood, like Mario, I mean, we talk all the time because he'll watch every race qualifying, you know. I mean, we may not catch every practice session, but that's okay. And watched qualifying yesterday, and of course, Lewis, surprise, he made a mistake, but everybody's entitled to one mistake a year. That's what we always said in F1. And then the race today, Lewis came up through the field, wonderful job there, coming, gaining 16 positions from the back, because he started from the pit lane, which in the end, of course, probably turned out to be a good deal because of the contacts in the first, second, third corners. And then he had a chance to get in front of Raikkonen after a pit stop, but he came out behind Raikkonen, as was the same case for his teammate Valtteri Bottas, who didn't get as good a start as Sebastian. And he came out after his first pit stop just behind Vettel, and he was never able to get near him. So, and it was good. I mean, Felipe's last Brazilian Grand Prix. It's always enjoyable. I always enjoy watching F1.
Great. You are a man of Formula One fascination, just like our listeners, but it was a race program of the 1960 Indy 500 that sparked your interest in motor racing. Please tell us about this.
Yeah, that's my grandparents were driving through Indianapolis on Memorial Day weekend, which is when the Indy 500 is held, and they brought a program back for me as a present. And I looked at that, and I was like, this is great. I've got to find out more about it. So I decided that I would go to see the Indy cars. In those days, they raced the weekend after Indianapolis 500 in Milwaukee, where I was born. So the fellow living in across the alley from us in Milwaukee, he was a track observer, Teddy George, and he took me along as his guest, and I was in the box, and that was the beginning.
How old were you then, and what do you remember most from this race in Milwaukee?
I was 12 years old at that time, and I just remember being in the pits and thinking I wanted to be a crew member. For some reason, I didn't envision myself as being a driver, even though I enjoy driving a lot, but I wanted to work on the pit crew, and that really instigated my interest.
In 1973, two events brought you into the world of Grand Prix racing. You joined American Airlines and made a trip to Watkins Glen. We all know what happened there on Saturday. Tell us a little bit about that weekend, please.
Yeah, that was my first race. And after I took the job with American in June 28th, 73, based on manning requirements, we had a choice of different cities for a crew member. And our choices were Chicago or New York. To me, there was no choice. I was, you know, growing up in Milwaukee, I didn't want to go to Chicago. I knew Chicago. And New York fascinated me. So went to New York. As I said, we graduated 28 June, 73. And then knowing the Grand Prix was coming to Watkins Glen in October, I said, right, I'm going to go see my first Grand Prix race. Well, I did that. I hopped on a bus and took it up from New York City here and went up. And when I got there that Saturday afternoon, Francois Sever had, you know, been killed in an accident there. And I hung out, you know, around the Tyrrell garage and Lotus, of course, and saw my first Grand Prix. And Ronnie Peterson won the race. But little did I know that 5 years later, I'd be working with Lotus at Watkins Glen with Mario.
Now, what made you decide to go into Formula One and not pursue an interest working in IndyCar racing?
Basically, it was a fascination. When the Formula One drivers, Revson and Stewart and Jimmy and Graham, were coming to Indianapolis to the 500 in the mid-60s, this was right after early 60s and mid-60s. It was right after I was right after the Indy cars were brought to my attention. But it was during that period when I saw these guys coming from Europe, and I was like, what is this F1? So coupled with that, the movie Grand Prix came out, which I saw 5 times in a theater in Milwaukee. And I just said, oh man, this, for some reason, that sparked my interest more than our domestic series. Nothing against the Indy 500, of course, which is still the greatest race and greatest spectacle in racing, I think. But I just said, you know what? This is interesting. And they're traveling around the world, which gives the true definition of a world champion.
Very true. Now, Monte Carlo, 1977, at the Grand Prix, you offered your services to Bob Dance of Team Lotus. What was his initial response?
Well, he was keen because one of my philosophies of life is if you see something needs doing, do it. It doesn't matter what it is. If somebody leaves a garbage bag, you know, outside your hotel room, I just automatically would pick it up and throw it in the bin where it belongs. Well, having that mentality, I was walking around the paddock at Lotus, And in those days, Lotus had a Travco motorhome, Mike and Ann Murphy being in charge of hospitality. And I noticed Mike loading these chairs up on the top of the Travco by himself. And I just walked up and instinctively said, "Hey, mister, can I give you a hand with those chairs?" And of course, once I started, then I started my verbal diarrhea, as I call it, chatting with him. And the next thing I asked him if he would introduce me to the chief mechanic. And I told Bob Dance at that time, I said, "I'm tired of sneaking into pits. I'm tired of sitting in the grandstand. I'm tired of just taking pictures. I want to do something here. I want to make a contribution because I love this environment. And I think I can, you know, I can help out somewhere. I'm not a mechanic, but you can train me." And that's what started it. And then in 78, Bob, I went to Long Beach, which I always did, to the Grand Prix there. It was the second year of the Grand Prix in Long Beach. And I said to Bob, he asked me actually, he said, "Are you coming to Monaco again?" And I said, "Oh yeah." He said, "Be there on Wednesday. We can use your help. We need a gopher." So I showed up. The first thing he did was put my little camera, my old camera, in a locker for me. And he said, "You won't be needing this now." And he said, "Go and clean body parts and gearbox and so forth." And so I was doing that. And then they had a new tire man. This was his first Grand Prix, Clive Hicks. And Bob said to me, he says, "You know what? Why don't you go and give Clive a hand on the tires?" Well, that was it. I was there 10 years with him.
Great.
With Clive.
Did you approach other teams also? And if not, why just Lotus?
No, I didn't. At that point, I didn't approach anybody. I had an interest in Lotus because of, you know, Jimmy Clark at Indy and Graham Hill. And there was a fascination with the JPS, the black and gold. And that was the first team I went. I mean, because I went and spoke to Mike Murphy. You know, it just all fell into place. So he, you know, that was where my instigation was. But in the end, I ended up working with Ferrari after Team Lotus.
Now, what was your first race as official Mario's little helper? And was he happy to see a fellow American on the team?
Yeah, it was the first official race was Monaco 78. And I'll never forget the first time I knelt down to do the pressures. I had no experience, but they trained me. I mean, you should be able to figure out how to take pressures, right? I'll never forget kneeling down to do the right front and looking up and seeing Mario in the cockpit and his eyes, you know, through the helmet looking at me. And I was, and of course, I'd introduced myself to him, so he knew who I was, you know. And I was like, how the heck did this all happen? And it just went there. Much the same when we went to work with Ferrari, did select races with them. It was like, wow. But by then, of course, I, you know, had established a little bit of an identity and reputation in the racing world in F1.
Okay. There are two sides to every story, and it was the same with the saga of Colin Chapman and in his dealings with his drivers and team members. What was your observation on this point on him? And let me just give you an example. We did an interview once with Mario Andretti, and I asked him, you know, a question, something like this. And he said to me that he one day saw Mario talk to Gunnar Nielsen, and Mario said to Colin that, "If you talk to me like this, I won't drive for you." So can you tell us a little bit about Colin's personality, being very strict and sharp as he could be sometime?
So what you're saying is that Gunnar told Mario something that Colin said to him.
No. Mario heard the conversation. Mario was there.
Oh, he heard the conversation between Colin and Gunnar.
Gunnar, yeah.
Oh. Well, I'm not surprised. Mario's very straightforward. Very straightforward. Colin was tough, you know. I mean, he respected Mario. I don't know what he said to Gunnar. I wasn't privy to that conversation. But for Mario to intervene and say something like that, it had to be pretty important. But Colin respected Mario, you know, and I don't think there was any ever any worry. But it doesn't surprise me also that Mario would say something on Gunner's behalf. You know, because I'm sure Colin would not speak to Ronnie Peterson that way either. Gunner was a new kid on the block, and so, you know, maybe Colin, he could be tough. I mean, he was tough. You know, he was tough with us, with the mechanics. I'll never forget the first race. We had set 13 on the tires, and he came over and he put his hands down, threw his hands down towards the ground, saying, "No, no, no, chaps, we don't put 13 on the tires, and we don't put 13 on the signal board," because I was also, they also had me doing the signal board. So it would have to be 12.9 or 14, you know, but not 13.3 or anything like that with 13. So he was tough, but, you know, and I mean, he like the Bolt, you know, like Bernie Ecclestone, and his nickname is the Bolt on the inside, because when he came in the shop, it was like a bolt of lightning. Because he would, you know, "What the hell is that? What's that?" You know, and like Nicky's the same way. He's very straightforward and right to the point. And Chapman was the same way. He was old school. You know, he wouldn't, you know. But I mean, it's not anything different today. I mean, they're not that worried about hurting people's feelings. You can't. In that business, you tell it like it is. Politically correct, whatever, it's, that goes out the window. You tell it exactly the way it is.
Yeah, it is pretty ruthless, and that's one of the things I do like.
Oh, I love that about the sport.
Yeah, yeah. Also the international flavor, and that's what really attracted to me also, apart from the noise. Right. Monza 1978, triumph and tragedy for the team. Tell us about this weekend, both in terms of Mario Andretti winning the world championship and the sad news following the day about his teammate Ronnie Peterson.
Yeah, it was a tough weekend. I still have a photo, nice black and white photo from Saturday afternoon that was taken down by Goodyear. And with the Goodyear tire truck in a lorry in the background as a background. And all the fitters from Goodyear and the entire team, which was only like 15 of us at the most, 12, 15 guys. And Mario and Ronnie sitting on the respective front tires. And We were looking good. I think Mario was on pole, but Ronnie qualified sixth, I think it was, if I remember correctly. And, I mean, we were cruising right along, and of course the only two people that could win the world championship, it was between Mario and Ronnie, because, you know, we had such a stellar year in 78 and 77. And this follow-up year was really put the nail in the box and let's bring this home. The constructors we had, and now we were just waiting to see what would happen on the driver's side. So, of course, the race starts and, you know, there's this big accident and it was bad. We knew it was bad. We didn't know how bad it was because, you know, you don't get near that stuff. We go out on the track and I was hanging on to Mario's helmet and he was being interviewed, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, his car was okay. So we had to do a restart. And in the pit lane, one of the marshals came and handed us Ronnie's helmet, which I immediately gave to his chief mechanic, Rex Hart. And we got penalized for jumping the start. And that put us, we ended up finishing, Mario ended up finishing sixth. And at that point, we, you know, because of Ronnie, the severity of Ronnie's accident, we assumed that he wouldn't be running the last couple races. Montreal, I think Montreal was the last one in those days. Anyway, so we didn't know, and we just packed up, but we assumed that Mario was champion, but there was no celebration or anything, of course, because Mario, or Ronnie was in hospital. And the next morning, we're leaving out of Linate to go back to England. And the boys were all sitting around at our gate. And I pick up a newspaper off of a cigarette bin. And I opened it up. And it said, Peterson El Morto. I'll never forget that. And I said, boys, look at this. I said, Ronnie's gone. Which is what Peterson Almorto means. That's how we found out about Ronnie's death.
Yeah, it was shocking.
Passing in the night.
Did you even believe that when you first read that? Because it was such a shock.
Well, no, of course not. You didn't. Because you knew the accident was bad, but we didn't know how bad it was. We already had a broken leg and so forth. But as we come to find out, he died of an embolism. The, you know, bone marrow got into the bloodstream. And that's what killed him.
Now, Ronnie was my favorite driver when I started following Formula One in 1973, and I saw a lot of him in Kimi Raikkonen of McLaren days. What was your impression of Ronnie as a person and driver, and any memories you can share with us?
Ronnie was very soft-spoken. His wife, Barbara, very much the same. And, you know, he had a typical Swedish personality, you know, quiet, to the point, very polite. And that weekend he was definitely troubled because he was going through contract negotiations with Colin, and he was deciding whether or not he was going to go to the Tyrrell. Was he going to stick around? He didn't want to be number two, so to speak, to Mario, because he respected his spot on the team, and that was very clear from the get-go that he was number two to Mario. But he was just a nice guy. I mean, much like this past year, I was Scott Dixon's tire man, Ganassi Racing. And his manager is Stefan Johansson. And, of course, I know Stefan from 30 years ago. And very much the same, very polite. You know, he's not one to come up and, intervene in a conversation. He'll stand quietly off to the side when there's an opening, you know, then he comes in. And Ronnie was the same way. And it was tough. It was tough to lose Ronnie that way.
Did you ever witness firsthand the Lotus Love Fest that was going on between Peter Waugh and Arnage?
Yeah. Oh boy, yeah, that was some love fest, all right. One of my favorite things about Peter Waugh, those are his initials, and that was his nickname in the pit lane. When we got rid of Nigel, at the end of the year, it was 82, I believe. And Peter Waugh's famous comment, rest in peace, my mate, Peter Waugh, because he brought me on to Lotus and looked after me, you know, when he appeared. People asked why he got rid of Nigel, and his famous comment was, as long as I've got a hole in my ass, Nigel will never win a Grand Prix. So there we are at the Race of Champions in Brands Hatch. Nigel Stepney was our chief mechanic, you know, at that time, and that was the year before Ayrton arrived, or 2 years before Ayrton arrived at Lotus. And Nigel wins his first Grand Prix race, because in those days the Race of Champions was considered part of the calendar. And of course, all we're doing, typical British humor, you know, taking the piss out of our mate and his quote. Everybody's walking around the garage saying, as long as I got a hole in my ass, that guy will never win a Grand Prix. Right? So, yeah, he never really warmed up to Peter Waugh, and vice versa.
Yeah, you know, Peter Waugh, shortly before he died, he was interviewed in Motorsport magazine. I don't know if you've read that interview. Man, even then, he was just like, he called Mansell an uncouth Brummy.
So, yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, he really thought he was a wanker. But you know, Patrick Head always used to say, you know, if we could take him out of the car and put him in a bubble, that would be perfect. We wouldn't have to deal with him outside the car. But when he's in that car and he pulls that visor down, pew, he's gone. Because, you know, he really pushed. And I was with him at his first Grand Prix when he ran with us at Lotus. And he sat in the fuel. Yeah. And that, you know, burned his backside up. And that just showed you the determination that he had to make it. And, of course, he finally did in 92.
Yes. You know, we were talking about the world being so global, Formula One and all that. But here's a proof that it is still a small world. A question from your day job. Do you remember a situation in the air when you were working for American Airlines? You went to the cockpit, offered a cup of Java to the captain. He turned around, saw your GPS belt buckle, and said, "You must be Kenny Shemansky."
Yes, you don't forget stuff like that. Yeah, that was Bob Bell, was his name, surname?
Bob Neal, Captain Bob Neal.
Captain Bob Neal, right, yeah. Yeah, you don't forget stuff like that. And yeah, I either wore a belt buckle, a JPS belt buckle, and I always had a little Lotus lapel pin that I wore on my jacket on the outside, and they never took off my jacket. And he noticed that right away, and I was like, wow, how does this guy know this? But by that time, the story had kind of filtered through, and I remember them asking me one time, they wanted to do a story in the company newspaper, the flagship news, but I turned them down. I said, no. I said, there's jealousies, and people would be like, well, he does that when he's not here, and I just said, no, I don't need it. I was getting enough press on the outside in the racing world. I didn't need it inside American Airlines.
Yeah, Captain Neal and I have been friends since 1986, and of course, he's a huge, huge Formula One fan. He told me the story when it happened. It's
right.
Not something I just heard.
Yeah.
So, interesting war. Okay, today's Formula One is very different than days of Colin Chapman and Keke Rosberg. What is your take on today's Grand Prix racing, full of technology and drivers who don't even talk to their own teammates?
For starters, I like many people, have no time for these grid penalties. When I'm watching qualifying and I see Daniel Ricciardo qualify fourth, I want to see him on the outside of the second row. I don't want to come to Sunday afternoon, you know, and see him back in 18th or 19th position along with the other grid penalty people. And that's something that they really need to change. And our boy Hobbsy and Tim Matchett, they all mention that quite often because they don't like it either. And they apparently asked Ross Brawn now, who's in charge, and he said this is in effect until 2020. So, excuse me, we've got it for another three more seasons. But, I mean, it's just, it really takes away from the show, you know, and I get what they're doing. They're trying to keep costs down. But in the old days, if you had an engine problem, you had an engine problem. You had to sort it out. But why should you, you know, be penalized because you have to change the engine and they have a limit on the number of power units that you can run throughout the year? You know, so that is one thing that really, you know, is disappointing about F1 right now. And as far as the drivers, I mean, they've always been very competitive, you know, and I don't know how much it's really changed since the old days. I think the driver is still pretty much, you know, because they have group, you know, they have briefings, team briefings, and, you know, what they hide from each other, who knows what goes on there. But I don't know it's changed that much. And I mean, the mechanics, of course, it is a different paddock. There's not that much time for the camaraderie until you step outside the gate. Then the boys are the boys, you know, and we meet you down in the reception in the hotel bar. It doesn't matter what team you're with.
We now have an American team in Formula One. What will it take to get the next Mario Andretti or Phil Hill in Formula One?
Well, we wish it would be Marco. I mean, he's the guy that really, you know, back in 08 when he had that good result and almost won the Indy 500, his hand was hot, and that's pretty much cooled off because he's concentrating on the Indy cars, you know, with his dad, Michael, running the show there. I don't know at the moment. There is a young lad in GP2, an American fella, or he's in F3, I think.
Are you talking Santino Ferrucci?
Yes, right. Yes, Santino. And he seems to be the one that's got the most pedigree at the moment. So we'll see, going through the proper channels. And Mr. Haas and that team, I mean, guaranteed they'll take a look at him because they would love a marriage like that, having an American driver.
What do you think of Alexander Rossi?
He's an interesting character, I'll tell you. I was on Andretti last year, Andretti Autosport. I was on Townsend Bell's car, which was teammate, you know, one of Rossi's teammates. And he's really proved his mettle. He beat us at the Glen this year. We took second to him and took some valuable points away from us in the running for the championship, which ultimately we didn't win trying to beat the four Penske cars. But interesting character. I got to know him last year a little bit, and it was nice to see he respected our pedigree in working so many years in Formula One. And I saw him last year at the Formula One race in Austin, and then, of course, the entire year I'd see him. And he's a good peddler. He's definitely a good peddler, and I think he'll be somebody to be reckoned with again this year in IndyCars.
Okay, I have a question from one of our listeners in England, Simon Steele. He wants to know, what do you remember of the relationship between Elio De Angelis and Senna?
Wow, Elio and Senna were, you know, in 85, they were fabulous. Ayrton, you know, he wanted the team to be for him. He had a specific first number one driver clause in his agreement. And Elio really didn't care for that. It bothered Elio. But I remember Ayrton telling me one time, he said, I didn't feel like Lotus could really support two number one drivers, which is why Ayrton was very particular about who he had in the seat next to him. Case in point, he didn't want Derek Warwick as his teammate because he thought he would be too close and that would cause too much aggravation inside the team. And Ayrton, he thought things through. Elio was good. Elio was really good. I mean, he was quick on his day. If he got fired up and got annoyed with something, he could beat Senna. I remember him qualifying pole position in 85 in Montreal. And he was fired up because he was going through contract negotiations with Lotus. And he just, you know, he was gone. He was quick in his day and a good bloke, a really good guy. Same as Ayrton.
The story of your life, personally and professionally, is captured in a Kodak moment from Estoril 1985 with Kenny Szymanski in the air and clapping. Tell us about this historical moment in the rain and what it means to you.
Yeah, really, that we get reminded of that photo quite often. Stephen T was the photographer there. And one of the good things about the picture is that it captures all the sponsors on the car. And, of course, the joy of Peter Warr standing on the right side with his arms outstretched. And Ayrton coming out of the cockpit in happiness. And then in the upper left-hand corner, yours truly in the air again. You know, the guy that flies with American Airlines. In the air, clapping. And it was pissing down rain all day. And that was a really great day because number one, it was a long time since we'd had a victory at Lotus. It was Ayrton's first Grand Prix win. And it just, that picture really, and the fact that it was raining and it was in black and white really gives you the mood of the day. And he didn't put a wheel wrong all day. Elio finished fourth. He had a slow leak in the left front. And I remember him coming to me in scrutineering. He said, Szymanski, which is what he always called me. He says, check the pressure in that left front. He said, I think it's down. Because in those days, we didn't have sensors, you know. So, but that picture, yeah, I have it at home. And I see Stephen T every year at Austin. And he's forever introducing me. He said, this is the guy jumping in the air. And people know right away, you know, which picture he's talking about. But it's a great memory, really a good memory. And, I mean, if you're going to have a little bit of a legacy, I think that's a good picture to have alongside your name.
I remember watching that race sitting like maybe 5 inches from the TV screen early morning in California. Just could not believe what was happening. Did you get to spend some time with Senna off the track? Did you got to know him a little bit personally?
Oh, yeah, because... Ayrton, after Montreal one year in 86, actually, he came to, he told me he was coming to New York, and he knew, you know, I lived in the city. And I said, okay, I said, just call me. I said, call me on, you know, at home. The same number that you've been calling, Nasser, because I still don't have a cell phone, right? And so every phone call is like a present, and it's a surprise, you know. So Ayrton, as he said he would, he called me. He says, okay, he says, Kenny, we're gonna meet up for dinner, and we're going to go to see the president of U.S. operations for Nacional, which was the Brazilian bank sponsor that he had. And he says he's right like five blocks away from your apartment. So I said, great. So we go up, I meet him there at the apartment, and we have a beautiful Brazilian dinner. And it was wonderful, you know. And that was before I really started flying Brazil. So I didn't know a lot of Portuguese, and I've always lamented the fact that I never knew, Ayrton never knew me as Borracheiro, which is the Portuguese Brazilian name for tire man, you know, because I know he would have enjoyed sharing that bond. Anyway, so after we have the dinner, I said to him, Ayrton, I said, you know, why don't you come and see my apartment? I have some items in there, you know, racing memorabilia and so forth. And his manager, Armando at that time, rest his soul, he said, oh, no, Kenny, no, no. He says, you know, we can do that some other time. But Ayrton, you know, which matches my mentality, do it now, much like what we got here today. He said, no, 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 we go to visit Kenny's apartment now. Wow. Because who knows when we're going to be back, if ever.
Wow.
You know? And so we went. He came up. And the first thing he did was look at the right front tire from Portugal 85. Because it's in my apartment, right? And he was examining the blocks and how clean they were. And I said, well, yeah, because, you know, as you know, I said it was pissing down like a cow on a flat rock. And there was very little wear. I mean, the edges of the blocks were rounded a little bit, you know, worn off. But for the most part, the tires were clean. And we just ran one set. He went nonstop, you know, that day. So it was a great honor. And then I had him sign the door. The first driver that came to visit the museum, which I call the 85th Street Museum, was Roberto Moreno, another Brazilian. And Ayrton signed the door, and he wrote on it, you know, the date 17/6/86, 17th of June. And then he wrote, up yours, Kenny, on the top. But below it, he wrote, with admiration and friendship, you know, your friend, Ayrton Senna. And after I finished the Formula One time with Lotus in 88, I went to work for Jaguar on the sports cars with Walkinshaw Racing. And the reason I'm thinking about this is because of Ayrton signing the door. People would ask me, because by then it was common knowledge, there was an American over there working for Lotus with Ayrton. The first question people asked me, oh, we hear Ayrton's conceited and he doesn't talk to the mechanics and, you know, he's not really a nice guy to work with because he's so demanding. And all I would say to them was, I got only one little story to tell you. I said, he's the first racing driver who signs his Christmas card personally. That just like shut him up. And I shared that story with Frank Williams when I went to visit Frank one time in his factory, in his office. We were sitting there together, just the two of us, and he's just got a small little picture, a headshot of Ayrton, you know, with his Nacional hat and his Rothman overalls. And I looked at that picture and I said, Frank, I said, I got to tell you a story. And I repeated, I said, I know you would appreciate it because he knew Ayrton the way we did, you know. And that's, in fact, just last week, I was in a restaurant here on 4th and 4th in the city called Phoebe's. And I was wearing a Ferrari jumper when I went in to visit this mate of mine who works there. And the bartender said to me, she says, oh, you're a Formula One fan? And I said, yeah, a little bit, you know. And she said, oh, I'm Brazilian. and I loved Ayrton. Oh, that just opened up the gates. We just started chatting, and I told her the story about the Christmas card. And so the next time I go in there, I have to, because I didn't throw those away. You don't throw stuff like that away, right? I told her, I promised her I would bring a couple of the Christmas cards so she could see them. Because he wrote, I mean, he wrote on the Christmas card, "To my friend Kenny, obrigado, you know, your friend Ayrton."
Fantastic. Great, great memories, and thanks so much for sharing with us. Finally, how about a message to listeners of F1 Weekly? We have listeners all over the world. If you want to say something to them.
Yeah, keep the spirit alive. There's changes abounding without our friend Bernie running the show, but F1 is still the pinnacle of motorsport, and don't stop reading about it. Don't stop going to see it. Don't stop watching the races, and, you know, support our teams. I mean, we've got a few of the old stalwarts that are still left in the series, and it's a great sport, and it's a great thing to have an interest in.
Kenny Chemetsky, thank you very much, sir, and a great honor and pleasure in meeting and talking to you.
Thank you, Nasser. A pleasure. My pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Cheers. Good luck, everybody.
Kenny, thanks again for joining F1Weekly.com. The check is in the mail. Nas, keep up the good work. That was outstanding. A quick prediction for Abu Dhabi.
I Abu Dhabi. How about another one for Max Verstappen?
That's a great idea. Which means another one for Tag Heuer.
Yes, the clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking. But indeed, I'm on the Kubica bandwagon. But I think Fernando gets on the podium in Abu Dhabi.
Okay, bless your heart, sir.
Thank you very much. So I want to thank all the listeners who put up with this. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.